in our series of lectures on the subject, The History of Religious Life Since Vatican II, Father John Hardin now gives part two of his lecture on Pope Paul VI's Exhortation to Religious. Father John Hardin.
Our third area of reflection is on authentic renewal. First, placing ourselves into the context in which the Pope wrote the exhortation, he refers to Lumen Gentium as having laid the doctrinal foundations. Then, Perfecti Caritatis as giving the norms for the Lumen Gentium doctrine being carried into effect. Unfortunately, as we know, in spite of by then some 6 years of the Church's documentation, much had happened in Vitiges' life that made him seriously question whether what the Church wanted as renewal was authentic renovation. The collective word change became the motto for chapters and development of their apostolates. For many communities, it seemed logical that drastic changes in secular culture called for corresponding changes in the religious life. And in fact, I suppose the single most ordinary way in which many religions were beguiled into introducing revolutionary changes in their community was because they were embarrassed or ashamed to, well, be called archaic or old-fashioned or preconciliar. So much so, as the Pope says, renovation became synonymous with revolution. Nothing was too sacred to be protected from removal, or at least complete alteration at the hands of the 20th century iconoclasts. Looking back in a way the Council could not have looked forward, the lapse of time in this case is crucial. At this stage in our course, this specific one, of religious life since Vatican II, it is of special moment, I think, to get these first few classes clearly in mind, because as we begin to see the history of religious life, we should never charge the Church with having provoked the revolution. It is not because what the Council taught or the Popes urged religious to do. It's the way the documents of the Church were interpreted to serve the preconceived notions of those who already had ideas as to what they wanted, then proceeded to shape religious life accordingly. From the end of the Council to the date of Pope Paul's exhortation, about 6 years, is normally a very short time in the life of the Church. You put almost 2,000 years, in the denominator, six on top makes a very small fraction. Nevertheless, I don't hesitate saying that more drastic changes were made in many communities in half a decade, in 5 or 6 years, than had been made in the previous 500 years. My own Society of Jesus, which I know and love so much, had introduced changes since the Council, such as had been non-existent in 4 centuries. The exhortation, therefore, builds on a richer experience, or to change the adjective, on a more tragic experience than a mere 5 or 6 years would normally suggest. The Pope did what we should expect him to do, say some strong words, though couched by and large in a document that was outstanding for its kindness. Yet, even as Christ did on occasion use strong language, so the very gentle Pope Paul could at times breathe fire. Nevertheless, the exhortation was essentially positive. As a result, the Pope did several remarkable things, and it is here that we enter on a new era, offering fruit for theological investigation, or what is more pertinent to all of us, for implementation in the religious life of the future. Pope Paul began by carefully distinguishing, in a way that had not been done before, on a cardinal principle of the life of the councils. And we can thank the iconoclasts for having provoked this distinction. The Pope sharply distinguished between the unchangeable fundamentals from the changeable accidentals of the religious life. Without this distinction, and being able to identify what are the essentials and what are the accidentals, no community was, or I have to admit, even today, is safe from demolition. No one in his right mind could question that there was need for change. There was call for progress. Yet, in the name of progress, so many things had been changed, which in the process of changing destroyed the essence of religious life. Besides the distinction I've just expressed, the Pope gave the basic reason why there are unchangeable fundamentals in the religious life. I should add, this is how the Consortium Praefecti Caritatis came into existence, about which we shall have time to speak more at length, because from next class on, we will go more into the history of religious life since Vatican II. But a group of religious women had first 85 communities, but before the year was up, down to 35 out of 85 identified and were willing to commit themselves to abide by these basic premises. A former mother general from out of town called me last night. They're having another chapter coming up. And she said, I haven't got the heart to watch another spectacle like the last three chapters. Further destruction. What can we do? I know her, I know the community. So I suggested, by now has become something of a formula. I said, Mother, would you, with the help of some people who think like you, draft a 2 or 3 page list of non-negotiable essentials of religious life, like superiors, like that you wear a habit, like that you have the Blessed Sacrament, that you attend Mass and receive Communion every day. At any rate, draw up some of these essentials in your own best English. Get a few others to agree that they too would like to see this. Now it would seem humanly impossible, religious life. But describe it. And before the chapter, make copies enough for every delegate of what you people believe are the essentials. Distribute those beforehand. And the least you will do is at least put some heart into a few sisters who hope somehow to spend their days in a religious community. Because the possibility of reforming some secularized communities, I would say, is almost nil. And to hope to somehow change the mind of a secularized administration, at least some that I know of, is not realistic. What then, in the Pope's language, is the reason why there must be unchangeable elements in the religious life? Why must there be such immutable essentials? Because this life is not a construct of man's genius. It is not something conceived by human reflection. It is part of the deposit of the Christian faith. Consequently, whatever pertains to the elements of the faith must be unchangeable. So the only question that remains to be asked is, what are these unchangeable elements? Whatever they are, they cannot change because Christ cannot change. And it was Christ, as the Holy Father brings out most lucidly, it was Christ who first practiced and preached the counsels of poverty, chastity, and obedience. It was Christ who first practiced, before he preached, selfless love. If then faith tells us that religious life is to be modeled on the life of Christ, to speak of changing those essentials would be a blasphemous claim that you're changing what Christ himself taught and in. Pope Paul further set the practical norm by which all institutes in the Catholic Church are to determine what are and what are not unchangeable fundamentals. It was not a coincidence that he called the exhortation to all members of religious institutes throughout the Catholic world. He was speaking to those who subscribe to that faith, their practical norm for renewal. He is the authority of the hierarchical church, finally terminating in the See of Peter. What are the fundamentals? That which the Catholic Church, under the Vicar of Christ, says are fundamentals. Finally, we close with something about the Vicar of Christ. Pope Paul VI spelled out what these fundamentals are in principle and must therefore be preserved in practice. He spoke of two kinds of fundamentals. One form pertains to the essence of the religious life as part of the deposit of faith. And watch this. He spoke of other fundamentals which do not precisely pertain to the faith, but are necessary to sustain, support, maintain, and keep alive the life of the councils, which is part of the faith. On the first level, what are these fundamentals? They are everything which, according to the gospel teaching, constitutes the evangelical councils. Concisely stated, it is actual poverty. That adjective cannot be qualified. Using the analogy of poor people, it means that religious are to lack things, even as Christ lacked things. He was without certain things that, naturally speaking, he liked. A religious community that has everything lacks one of the essentials of religious life. It lacks actual poverty. And even as I say this, I know that even you are making distinctions. You have to. Because you know as well as I do that communities in the United States, with almost no exceptions, are not poor communities. They don't lack, and no amount of flowery talk will change the fact. They don't lack. Now, what do you do? Well, this would seem to be the easiest thing in the world. It would seem to be much harder when you lack to acquire. It would seem to be the easiest thing in the world when you possess to, dispossess. I've given too many retreats. I've been involved in too many chapters. I've spoken to too many villages. the privates, and the officers not to know that, and watch what I'm saying, if religious life continues to flourish in the United States beyond this century, it will only be among those communities that have made that very, very, very hard decision of dispossessing themselves. And by now there are too many books, too many conferences have been held proving the contrary. But I think the dearth of vocations is the most eloquent witness to the need for actual poverty. It secondly means we're talking about fundamentals. You read the document. He's talking about poverty. Second, authentic celibacy. Which knows nothing about a third way between celibacy and marriage. It was a Chicago provincial who had me read the then current issue of Sisters Today, in which there was a very learned article written by a priest religious on Cana for celibates, on how to develop and cultivate friendships, men with women, and be it said, women with men. Short of pregnancy. That's in Sisters Today. This is a celibacy that makes no compromise with the kind of chastity that Christ Himself lived out. It is a celibacy that is not only in the body, but what needs repeating, celibacy of spirit. I would like to call celibacy of the imagination. Religious women that would be insulted if you question their chastity are living in imagination lives that are inconsistent with their vowed commitment.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.